All right, let's jump right in. Today, we're going to be taking a deep dive into a fascinating question about ancient Israel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you reached out because you were really curious about altars and the history of altars. Like, specifically this debate about, were the Israelites only supposed to have one central altar?
Right.
Or could they have multiple? I mean, it might seem like a tiny detail, but mm-hmm. it really gets into some pretty big questions about religious practice and authority.
Oh, absolutely.
And how we interpret these ancient texts. So we've got some excerpts here from a lecture by Old Testament scholar Robert Vannoy.
Okay.
And he really lays out some of the key arguments in this debate. So
yeah, it's a fascinating debate for sure.
It is, yeah. What do you think is sort of at the heart of it?
Well, I think it really boils down to how we interpret ancient texts.
Okay.
And, you know, there's a lot of back and forth between scholars about what the evidence actually tells us.
Mm.
So it's not a simple answer.
Yeah, it's definitely not. So let's start with one of the most important passages that comes up, which is Exodus 20:24-26.
Right.
And this is where it says that the Israelites should build altars from uncut stones and earth.
Uh-huh.
So sounds pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah, on the surface.
Yeah. But the question is, does this apply only to their time wandering in the wilderness, or does it carry over to when they settle down in Canaan?
That's the big debate, right?
Right. Yeah. Because some scholars believe that those instructions were specifically meant for their life in Canaan.
Uh-huh.
And they point out that the law was given, you know, before the golden calf incident and before the 40 years of wandering. It's like
packing for a trip before you even know where you're going.
Uh-huh. Exactly. Yeah. You're like, I don't know what to pack if I don't know where I'm going.
Right. Right.
So maybe they were already thinking ahead to that settled life. Right.
Yeah, possibly.
Okay. So we've got this passage that seems to suggest maybe multiple altars. Mm-hmm. And then we get to Deuteronomy 12.
Yeah.
And it seems to push for a single centralized altar.
Yeah. That definitely complicates things.
Right. It throws a wrench in things.
It does.
So how do we make sense of that?
Well, I think the core tension really is, were multiple altars allowed, like Exodus might hint at?
Right.
Or was there a shift towards one designated altar, like Deuteronomy seems to suggest?
Okay, so let's dig into Deuteronomy 12 a little bit.
Sure.
Specifically, verse 14. It says, offer them only at the place the Lord will choose in one of your tribes, and there observe everything I command you.
Mm-hmm.
So one place, chosen by God, case closed, right?
Well, not so fast.
Okay.
The Hebrew phrasing here is a little trickier than it might seem at first.
Okay.
In one of your tribes could also mean in any one of your tribes.
Oh, interesting.
So it might not be talking about one single location, but potentially multiple locations chosen by God.
I see. So the language
in a different tribe
is open to some interpretation here.
It is.
But why would they write it so ambiguously?
Well, that's the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
And it actually gets even more interesting when you look at Deuteronomy 18.6.
Yeah.
It uses very similar phrasing. You know, it talks about from one of your gates.
Uh-huh.
But in that context, it clearly refers to any Levite from any gate.
Ah, okay. So we've got this.
We have one specific gate.
Precedent where the same language doesn't necessarily mean one and only one.
Exactly.
It makes you wonder then if the place in Deuteronomy 12.11 could also be talking about multiple spots that God designated. Okay.
It's a possibility.
So we're seeing that it's not as clear cut as maybe we initially thought.
Right.
And then there's this other piece of the puzzle.
Yes.
The Korah rebellion in number 16.7.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is where it uses the singular, the man, to talk about what was probably a whole group of people rebelling against Moses and Aaron.
A whole group.
So the man could be a whole crowd.
Well, it seems that way, right?
Yeah, that changes things.
It does. It really reinforces the idea that singular phrasing in these texts doesn't always equal singularity in reality. If the man can be a group, then the place could also potentially be multiple locations.
Right. So based on these clues, it's possible that maybe multiple altars were okay. But wait a second. Let's think about the logistics.
Okay.
Because Deuteronomy 12.18 talks about families, servants, like everyone trekking to this chosen place for major festivals.
Right.
So we're talking about families from, let's say, Dan. which is over 150 kilometers north of Jerusalem.
Wow.
Making that journey three times a year.
Yeah.
With their kids, their animals, all their supplies.
It's a lot.
Probably on foot or maybe a donkey.
At best.
Yeah.
It's a serious commitment.
Yeah, that's not very practical.
No, doesn't sound like it.
And what about the Levites?
Oh, yeah. They'd be constantly on the road.
Right. Going back and forth.
Back and forth.
All the time. So that's where scholar Baruch Halwarda comes in. And he argues that, you know, having only one place of sacrifice just wouldn't have worked logistically in ancient Israel.
Uh-huh.
And he proposes that they probably had a system of local altars.
Okay.
Alongside a central sanctuary, which would have been Shiloh at first, right, and then later Jerusalem.
Uh-huh.
So it's kind of like having local community centers.
You like that analogy?
Yeah. And then a big national hub. Right.
That makes sense.
Okay. But wouldn't that contradict the idea of God choosing the place?
Well, not necessarily.
Okay.
Remember, Deuteronomy 12.21 actually suggests limitations on where altars could be built based on distance and practicality.
Right. You wouldn't be expected to travel for weeks just to offer a sacrifice.
Exactly.
So maybe multiple altars were allowed, but with some guidelines and with some divine oversight.
Right.
It's not like they're popping up on every street corner.
Exactly. Yeah.
So how could this system have worked in practice?
Well, think about it. It could have helped the Israelites keep their faith distinct.
Yep. You know,
they were surrounded by all these Canaanite religions.
Right.
And this way they could avoid getting too influenced.
Yeah.
But still practice their faith without it, you know, totally upending their lives.
Right. Because having one central location would just be
logistically a nightmare.
Yeah. A logistical nightmare.
Yeah.
So it sounds like this is a pretty compelling argument.
It's pretty
for the possibility of multiple altars, right?
Yeah. It definitely challenges the traditional view.
And it's not just about the practicalities. It's also about how they were defining themselves in relation to the other cultures around them.
Exactly.
This is really fascinating.
It is.
These seemingly small details can open up
a
whole new understanding of how ancient religions actually worked.
Absolutely. And it reminds us that ancient texts aren't always black and white.
Mm, that's true.
You know? There are layers of meaning and interpretation that we need to unpack.
Speaking of different interpretations, another scholar, G.T. Manley, has a similar take to Halwarda.
Okay.
He argues that Deuteronomy 12 isn't really about the number of altars, but about their nature.
Interesting.
He actually has this great quote. He says, "The real focus in the context of Deuteronomy 12 is not between many Yahsheh altars in one, but between those of the Canaanites and the place and name of where Yahsheh shall abide."
That's powerful.
It is. So it's not about the quantity. It's about the quality and making sure that they were aligned with God's command.
And distinct from.
And separate from what the other religions were doing.
Right.
And to add to that, you know, Deuteronomy 16.21, 22, and 27, they all seem to acknowledge the existence of multiple authorized altars.
Right.
So this isn't just Halwarda and Manley.
Right.
Other scholars like Thompson and Segal, they have similar conclusions.
Yeah. So this multiple altar idea isn't some fringe theory.
It's not.
It's a real contender.
It's a real contender.
Yeah.
Wow. This deep dive is blowing my mind already.
Fascinating stuff.
We started with what seemed like a really simple question about altars, and now we're talking about religious practices and interpretation and and ancient history, and it makes you think really critically about about what we think we know.
Absolutely. And it opens up even more questions.
Right.
Like, if multiple altars were permitted,
what
does that tell us about how religious authority worked in ancient Israel alongside, you know, these more localized expressions of faith?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder how they balanced the need for unity with this diversity of beliefs and practices.
It's a fascinating puzzle, isn't it?
It is. It's like a puzzle with endless pieces.
Exactly. There's always more to discover.
Yeah.
More layers to peel back.
All right. Well, we've definitely gotten our brains working here.
We have.
But I think it's a good point to pause and let our listener kind of digest all this amazing information.
Take a breath.
Yeah, take a breath. We've uncovered some pretty groundbreaking stuff.
Yeah, we have.
So just take a moment to think about what's standing out to you, what's surprising you, and are you starting to question some of the things you thought you knew about ancient Israel?
Absolutely. It's always good to question our assumptions.
And we'll be back in just a moment to dive even deeper into this fascinating topic.
Can't wait.
Me neither.
You know, it's really fascinating to think about how these debates about, you know, ancient Israel are still relevant for us today.
Yeah.
It makes you kind of wonder, if some of our own assumptions about history could be based on incomplete or maybe simplified interpretations, you know?
You're totally right. It's like we're looking at the past through a foggy window sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So speaking of assumptions, I want to circle back to something you said earlier about the Canaanite influence, because it sounds like the presence of other religions in the area really played a role.
Oh, absolutely.
In shaping Israelite practices.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You're picking up on a really important point.
Yeah.
You know, the Israelites, they weren't living in isolation.
Right.
They were surrounded by all these people with different beliefs, different customs.
Yeah.
And, you know, the scholars we're looking at, they really suggest that this concern about Canaanite influence was a major factor in how they thought about, you know, regulating altars.
So it wasn't just about, like, how many altars there were, but also about making sure that they were distinct from those used in Canaanite worship.
Yeah, it was about keeping that separation clear between Yahweh and the gods.
Did things differently.
Or the surrounding nations.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that distinction, it wasn't just theological.
Right.
It had real-world implications, right? Because Canaanite religions often involved practices that the Israelites considered, you know, morally wrong.
Yes, very much so.
So the concern about altars wasn't just about, like, religious purity, but also ethical conduct.
Absolutely.
So it makes sense. If you're trying to build a society that's based on Yahweh's laws, you can't let your religious practices get all mixed up with what your neighbors are doing.
Yeah, it's about setting a standard, right?
Right, yeah. So it seems like there was this tension between wanting to be distinct, but also maybe being influenced or having to kind of figure out how to navigate those influences.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting to think about how this whole debate about altars reflects some of those broader tensions within Israelite society, right? On the one hand, you've got this desire for unity, right? Like, they want a central place where all the tribes can come together to worship Yahweh. But on the other hand, they also recognize that people need ways to express their faith locally, to have those altars that are accessible to them in their communities.
So they're trying to balance this need for, like, shared national identity, religious cohesion with, like, the practical realities of people's lives. Yeah, and the diversity of their beliefs.
Absolutely.
It's a tension that we still grapple with today, don't you think?
Oh, for sure.
Like, how do we balance unity and diversity? How do we create a sense of shared identity while respecting individual beliefs?
Huge questions.
Yeah, huge questions. And it's so interesting to see how it played out back then. This deep dive is really giving me a whole new perspective on ancient Israel.
Yeah.
It's not just a bunch of stories.
Yeah.
It's a real society.
Right.
With all the complexities and contradictions that come with being human.
That's what makes it so fascinating, right?
It does. So we've talked a lot about, like, interpretations and the historical context.
Yeah.
But I'm also curious about, like, the altars themselves.
Yeah, right. What do they actually look like? How big were they?
Yeah.
Were they elaborate? Were they simple?
Well, that's a great question.
Yeah.
And it's one that's, you know, fascinated archaeologists and historians for a long time.
Right.
Unfortunately, actually finding physical evidence of these ancient Israelite altars is a lot harder than you might think.
Really?
Yeah.
You'd think something so central to their religious life would have left more of a trace.
You would think.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of reasons for this.
Okay.
First of all, a lot of these altars were probably made of materials that just decay over time, like earth and wood.
Right.
They wouldn't have survived the centuries.
So you're just gone?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. And second?
Well, the Israelites, you know, they were conquered and displaced many times throughout their history.
Right.
Which means that their sacred sites were often destroyed or repurposed by other cultures. So it's like trying to solve a mystery with only half the clues.
Exactly. But even with all those challenges, archaeologists have actually found some pretty tantalizing pieces of the puzzle.
Like what?
For example,
excavations
at Tel Beersheba in southern Israel. They uncover the remains of what they believe to be a large altar from the 8th century BCE.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive.
So what can this altar tell us about how they were using them or what they looked like? Or
well, for one thing, it's massive.
Okay.
It's made of uncut stones, just like the description in Exodus 20. And it was located in a really prominent spot within the city.
Oh, okay.
Which suggests it played a really important role in public life.
So it wasn't just a small private shrine. Mm-hmm. It was like a major public monument.
It was a big deal.
Yeah, like a town square kind of thing.
Exactly. And, you know, that really supports the idea that altars weren't just for individual worship.
Right.
Or they're also symbols of communal identity, social unity.
Yeah, like bringing people together.
Bringing people together, exactly.
Around this shared faith.
Mm-hmm.
So the Tel Beersheba altar sounds pretty impressive.
It is.
Are there other examples like that?
Well, there have been discoveries of smaller altars and, you know, what they call cultic installations throughout Israel. But it's really hard to date them precisely or to say for sure if they were specifically used by Israelites.
So there's still a lot of mystery surrounding these ancient altars.
Absolutely.
And I guess that's part of what makes it so captivating, right?
It is. Yeah. It reminds us that history is an ongoing process of discovery.
Yeah.
There's always something more to learn, more to uncover.
Speaking of learning, I'm super curious about the rituals and practices that went on at these altars. How did they actually use them? What kinds of sacrifices?
Yeah, what did they do there?
Did they offer? Was it like what we see in the movies?
Well, to answer that, we kind of have to rely on both the biblical texts and what archaeology can tell us. You know, the Bible describes a whole variety of sacrifices.
Okay.
You've got burnt offerings, grain offerings, peace offerings, sin offerings.
Oh, wow. A whole menu of offerings.
Yeah, a whole menu.
So what was the purpose behind all these different types?
Well, they serve different purposes.
Okay.
You know, from expressing gratitude to God to seeking forgiveness for wrongdoing.
Okay.
For example, the burnt offering that was considered like the ultimate gift to God.
Okay.
A symbol of complete dedication.
Okay. So a really big deal.
Yeah. Big deal.
What about the other kinds of offerings?
Well, you know, the grain offering was a way of acknowledging God's provision and blessing.
Okay.
While the peace offering was more about a shared meal between the worshiper and God.
Oh, okay.
Representing reconciliation and fellowship.
So it sounds like the sacrificial system was really complex and multifaceted.
It was.
Like, it wasn't just about like going through the motions. It was about expressing a whole range of emotions and intentions.
Right.
Yeah. Can you paint us a picture?
Well, imagine you're standing before the altar.
Yeah.
The smoke rising.
Uh-huh.
The smell of the sacrifice filling the air.
Mm-hmm.
It has been a very powerful, very emotional experience.
I can only imagine. It sounds like a way of connecting with something bigger than yourself, of expressing gratitude, of seeking forgiveness, of like reaffirming your commitment to Yahweh.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just about individual piety either, you know.
Oh, okay.
These sacrifices often took place in a communal setting.
Right.
They were bringing people together to share a common experience.
So these altars weren't just physical structures, they were also focal points for like religious, social, even political life in ancient Israel.
You got it. They were at the very heart of what it meant to be an Israelite.
Wow. This deep dive is really helping me to understand just how significant those altars were. They weren't just about sacrifice. They were symbols of faith, community, identity.
Absolutely.
For the Israelites.
Yeah.
Now, we talked about those different interpretations of the biblical texts about altars.
Right.
But what about the archaeological evidence?
Okay.
Does that shed any light?
Yeah, good question.
On this debate about whether multiple altars were permitted?
That's a great question. And, you know, as we discussed earlier, actually finding physical remains of Israelite altars is really tricky.
Right.
And the ones that we have found are often open to different interpretations.
So there's not like a smoking gun, you know, an archaeological site that definitively proves or disproves this idea of multiple altars.
Not exactly.
Yeah.
But there are some, I think, intriguing hints that suggest a more decentralized picture.
Okay.
Than maybe the traditional single altar interpretation might suggest.
Ooh. Tell me more. What kind of hints?
Well, for example, excavations at various sites throughout Israel have revealed the remains of smaller, you know, what they call cultic installations, often in homes or rural settings.
Okay.
These might have been used for private
Oh, interesting.
For family rituals.
So not just the grand monumental altars, like the one at Tel Beersheba. There were these smaller, more localized places of worship, too.
Yeah, exactly. And that lends some support to the idea that religious practice in an ancient Israel was more diverse and more decentralized than we might initially think.
Yeah, it challenges this image we have of a really rigid, top-down religious system.
Right, like a one-size-fits-all.
Yeah, and it suggests maybe a more nuanced and dynamic understanding of Israelite faith. This is all so fascinating. It's really making me rethink what I thought I knew about ancient Israel.
That's what we're here for.
Yeah, and it highlights the importance of looking at both the written texts and the archaeological evidence.
It's all part of the puzzle.
Yeah. Trying to piece it all together. This deep dive has given me a lot to think about.
It's a lot to take in.
I never realized that something as seemingly simple as an altar could be so complex and tell us so much.
It's true. And it's a reminder that history is full of surprises. The more we learn, the more we realize how much we still don't know.
Speaking of discoveries.
Okay.
I'm curious about something else.
Right.
We've talked about the physical altars. We've talked about the sacrifices.
Right.
But what about the people who were actually performing these rituals?
Yeah. Who were these people?
Yeah. Who were the priests? And what was their role in ancient Israelite society?
Ah, the priesthood. That's another fascinating piece of this whole story.
Okay.
You know, the priests were essential to this whole sacrificial system.
Right.
They were the ones acting as intermediaries between the people and Yahweh.
So it wasn't just anyone
right.
who could just offer sacrifices.
Yeah.
It was a specialized role.
It was a big deal.
Okay.
Yeah. The priesthood was actually a hereditary position.
Oh, wow.
Passed down through the tribe of Levi.
Okay.
And they were responsible for maintaining the sanctuary, preparing the sacrifices, and making sure that all the rituals were carried out.
Right, right.
According to these very strict guidelines.
That sounds like a pretty demanding job.
It was. You know, they had to make sure that everything was done exactly right.
Yeah.
Because any mistake could invalidate the offering.
Oh, no.
And potentially anger Yahweh.
So the priests held a lot of power and authority.
They did. You know, they were seen as the guardians of religious tradition, the interpreters of God's law, and really the bridge between humanity and the divine.
Now, I'm curious
about
the relationship between the priests and the monarchy.
Okay.
Did they always see eye to eye?
That's a great question.
Or was there some tension between religious and political power?
Well, the answer is complicated.
Okay, of course.
You know the relationship between the priesthood and the monarchy? It was often tense.
Okay.
You know, as each group kind of vied for power and influence.
Can you give me an example of that tension?
Sure. You know, one famous example is the conflict between King Saul and the prophet Samuel.
Okay.
Now, Samuel, he was also a priest.
Okay.
And he anointed Saul as king, but later he rebuked Saul for disobeying God's commands.
So even the king wasn't above.
Right. It's like, hey, I made you king.
Uh-huh.
Don't think you're above the rule.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But even the king wasn't above the authority of the priesthood.
In theory, no. You know, the priests were seen as upholding divine law.
Right.
Which was considered superior to any human authority.
But I'm sure there were times when kings tried to, like,
of course,
assert their power over the priesthood.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, power struggles between religious and political leaders. That's a constant theme throughout history, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like a tug of war.
It is.
That never really ends.
Yeah, for sure.
It's so interesting to see how these dynamics played out back in ancient Israel.
And it reminds us that even religious institutions, they're entangled with these complexities of power and politics.
Right. No one is immune.
No one is immune.
To those dynamics.
Yeah.
This deep dive has really opened my eyes.
Yeah.
I feel like I have a whole new understanding of ancient Israel. The complexity of their religious practices.
Yeah.
And the enduring power of faith and tradition.
It's amazing how these ancient stories, you know, they still speak to us.
They do.
Yeah.
So we've covered a lot of ground today.
We have.
We've talked about interpretations, archaeological evidence, the Canaanite influence rituals, the priesthood.
A lot.
It's a lot, yeah.
Yeah.
But before we wrap up, I want to kind of go back to something you mentioned earlier about this relationship between, like, centralized religious authority and these localized expressions of faith.
Yes. That tension is fascinating, isn't it?
It is. It seems like the Israelites are constantly trying to strike a balance between, like, the need for unity and the reality of diversity.
Exactly.
Okay.
On the one hand, they wanted to maintain this sense of national identity, religious unity, centered on the worship of Yahweh.
Right.
But they also recognized that people needed ways to express their faith locally.
Right.
To have those altars that were accessible to them in their own communities.
So it wasn't about enforcing like a single rigid religious system.
Right.
It was about finding a way to accommodate these different levels of practice and belief.
Yes, exactly.
Within like a broader framework.
It's a challenge, isn't it?
It is a challenge. Mm-hmm. And it's one that we still grapple with today in so many different ways.
For sure.
Right? Like, how do we create that sense of shared identity while respecting individual beliefs and practices? How do we balance unity with diversity?
Yeah, timeless questions.
Timeless questions. And it's amazing to see how the ancient Israelites were wrestling with those same questions.
Thousands of years ago.
Thousands of years ago. Wow. This whole deep dive has been so enriching.
Yeah.
I feel like I have a much deeper appreciation for the richness and complexity of ancient Israelite culture.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It is. And I hope it encourages our listeners to keep exploring this topic, because
There's always more.
There's so much more
to learn, more to discover, more to ponder.
Exactly. But before we get ahead of ourselves,
I
think we should give our listener a moment.
Take a breath.
Yeah. To process all this amazing information.
Yeah.
So take a moment. Reflect on what we've discussed. What's standing out to you the most? What new insights have you gained?
Yeah. What are you thinking about?
About ancient Israel and their religious practices.
Yeah.
We'll be back in a flash to explore even more about this fascinating topic.
Can't wait.
Okay, we're back. Ready to keep uncovering the mysteries of those ancient altars.
I'm ready. It's amazing how something that seems so simple can open up like so many different avenues of inquiry.
Yeah, we've gone from talking about stones and sacrifices to like unpacking religious authority and social dynamics and political power struggles.
Yeah. It's like peeling back the layers of an onion. Each layer reveals something new and even more intriguing.
And just when you think you have a handle on things, there's another layer.
Exactly.
I think that's what makes history so fascinating.
It's this endless journey of discovery.
It is.
Yeah.
So speaking of discoveries, I want to bring us back to something you mentioned earlier about the fact that, you know, the Israelites weren't operating in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. They were surrounded by all these other cultures and religions and ways of life.
Absolutely.
So how did that influence their beliefs and practices?
That's a great question. And it's one that has, you know, sparked a lot of debate among scholars.
Okay.
Some argue that the Israelites were fiercely, you know, monotheistic from the very beginning, and they completely rejected any influence from those polytheistic beliefs that were all around them.
Okay.
But then others suggest that their beliefs maybe evolved over time.
Okay.
And that they might have actually incorporated elements of other religions into their own practices.
So it's not like a simple black and white issue.
No.
It's more like a tapestry, right? With threads from all these different traditions.
Beautiful. Now
it's kind of woven together.
Yeah. And we have to remember, too, that the ancient world was a very different place.
Right.
The idea of one God and one God only was not the norm.
Right.
Most cultures believed in a whole pantheon of gods and goddesses.
Right.
And there was a lot of fluidity and exchange
between
different religious traditions.
So it wouldn't be surprising if the Israelites were influenced by their neighbors.
To some extent,
Yeah. And in fact, I mean, the Bible itself acknowledges this, right? There are a lot of instances where the Israelites are warned against adopting practices.
Yeah, like don't do what they're doing.
Yeah, from the Canaanites, from the Egyptians.
Yeah, stay true to Yahweh.
From all these other surrounding peoples. Yeah. So it seems like they were constantly like negotiating their own identity in relation to these other cultures. Mm-hmm. They were trying to figure out
about boundaries, isn't it?
Yeah, what made them unique?
Yeah.
What set them apart?
Exactly.
And that process of like defining themselves wasn't always easy.
No, it was messy.
It was messy, yeah.
It was a process.
Yeah. It makes me think of that quote from Manly.
Yeah.
The real focus in the context of Deuteronomy 12 is not between many Yahweh altars in one, but between those of the Canaanites and the place and name of where Yahweh shall abide.
That's such a powerful statement, isn't it?
It is. And it really highlights the fact that it wasn't just about how many altars the Israelites had, but about what those altars represented.
Exactly.
About, like, drawing a distinction between Yahweh and the gods of their neighbors.
Yeah, drawing a line in the sand.
Yeah, exactly.
Between us and them.
So how successfully do you think they were?
That's a good question.
To maintain that line.
You know, I think it was a constant struggle.
Yeah.
I mean, they faced pressure from both within and outside their community.
Right.
You know, they had internal debates about how to interpret and apply God's laws. Mm-hmm. And then they had this external pressure from those surrounding cultures.
It sounds like a time of just
tremendous
change and upheaval.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But it was also a time of incredible creativity.
Oh, interesting.
And innovation.
Okay.
You know, they were forging their own unique identity, developing their theological system, figuring out their way of life.
Right.
And I think those debates about altars were really a crucial part of that process.
It's amazing how those ancient debates
isn't it?
Still resonate with us today.
They do.
We're still asking questions about, like, religious identity and cultural influence and how our faith is expressed in our daily lives.
It's a human story, right?
It is, yeah.
It transcends time and place.
This whole deep dive has been so eye-opening for me.
Yeah.
I feel like I have a completely new understanding.
I love that.
Of ancient Israel and the complexities of religious practices and the enduring power of, like, faith and tradition.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah. So to our listener, thank you for joining us on this incredible journey. I hope you've enjoyed
It's been a pleasure.
This deep dive into the world of ancient Israelite altars.
Yeah.
It's a reminder that even the smallest details can reveal these really profound insights into the lives and beliefs of people who lived thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
And who knows, maybe this will inspire you to do some exploring of your own.
I hope so. There's so much out there.
Yeah, there is. So until next time, keep asking those questions, keep seeking knowledge, and keep diving deep.
Absolutely.